Okay. My name is Alicia Sell. Today is October 19th, 2006. I am interviewing Richard Chubb, and we are doing the interview at the Gainsborough Library. Thank you for joining us today, Mr. Chubb. We're going to start by just asking some general background questions about you. Can you tell me where and when you were born?
I was born May 28th, 1936. And I was born at Burrough Memorial Hospital in Roanoke, Virginia.
How long have you lived in Gainsborough?
I lived in this area. For a few years, I lived on 7th Avenue Northwest. And then I lived on Chestnut Avenue, which is down from Burrough Memorial Hospital. And at the present time, I live from 1961 to the present time on Leon Street in Northwest.
Okay. Tell me about your parents, brothers, and sisters.
Well, my daddy's name was Leon, and mother was named Penella Lorraine. And I have two sisters, one Penella Lorraine Wilson, and then Minion Chubb Hale. We have a very good background because not only that I learned that we had history here in Roanoke, but we were actually from a place called Chubbtown, Georgia, about 18 miles from Rome, Georgia, which the church that my great-grandfather and his seven brothers built in 1870 is still there. So I'm beginning to realize we had so much history other than Roanoke. Now, how my grandparents got to Roanoke, it was a flood in Chilltown, Georgia. And some of them left to come this way to the railroad, Chattanooga, Indianapolis, and then many of them still down in Chilltown.
Okay. Did you have extended family, like aunts or uncles, that lived nearby here in Roanoke?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
How close were those family ties?
Well, I had one aunt that lived next door, majority of the time, and her name was Erie Williams. And then I had other relatives, you know, uncles and uncles that lived in the area, as well as an aunt and uncle that lived in Christianburg, and they had 10 children, you know. But in Roanoke, there were quite a few of us after the people left Chilltown, Georgia.
Did you spend a lot of time together with your extended family?
Oh, yes.
Would you see them on a regular basis?
Oh, yes. Especially on my mother's side at first, you know. And the reason being because my aunt, a lot of times, she lived next door. And one of the greatest thing I like about the African-American family, that at the time, we bonded so close because it's like, it was nothing like, you know, be with your grandmother or your close family because you couldn't afford babysitters. So we had to be close to survive. So it was just automatic closeness. Economics comes a little out of it.
Can you describe your houses for me? Were they, for instance, were they brick? Or do you remember having a garden?
No. Were they brick? No, mm-hmm. They weren't brick. And you say a garden? Mm-hmm. Yes, we had a garden.
Did you?
Yeah, that was a great resource because, as I said before, parents knew how to take a little and do quite well with it. In fact, I never could bring a person home that I couldn't help share a meal with them because we had a garden and Mama could can and cook well. You know, people there, they knew how to cut that loaf of bread and serve, I'd say, many people.
What kind of things did you have in your garden?
We had, you know, string beans, and plus we had, like, tomatoes and corn. The basic things that could make it, you know. In fact, we even had potatoes, you know. And we had trees in the garden, apple trees and damaged trees, and things like it. Anything that maybe you could do. In fact, one time we even had chickens, you know. And that helped quite a bit too. But as I said before, we were rich, and I want to spell this out because it's nothing like having a mom and dad you can count on. And that was a very important, you know, that structure was so well disciplined and everything. So with that type of help and with a garden and all, as I see it, I could never not bring a friend home and eat.
What kind of work did your father and mother do?
Well, my father, he worked five jobs, you know. Two of them, as a family, we worked with him. He had to clean up the Christian Science Church and employment office. So those two, the family had to help. The other jobs were little jobs on the side he would work like. He taught me so much about self-esteem. One of them, when they first came out with a buffer, we didn't have the electric buffer. We had a one that you had to push with your hand and put a rag. So we would clean folk flows, sometimes with white amico gas. So it was a matter of getting anything in the world to take care of the family. So my daddy, he worked majority of the time. His main job was at Shepherd's Auto Supply. And mother, most of the time, she was a housewife until we started growing up, and then she was doing day work.
Okay. What kind of activities did you participate in as a child and as a teenager here in Roanoke?
Well, one of the better things is come here to the library. The other thing we participated in, there was a lot of neighborhood things. We had block parties. I participated in athletics, mostly basketball. The other thing about it, we had a lot of activities that we played together in the community, you know, like shooting marbles. I was a pretty good marble shooter. And things of that nature, you know, like I said, the library, you know, we come in, and that was a gathering place. Across the street was a grocery store, and then after we leave the movies, we come there. So we had dancing, we had the Y across the street, and they had dances on, and they had, we could shoot pool over there. We had dances on Wednesday night, and also Saturdays at the boys' Y, and the girls' Y, we had it on dancing on Fridays. That was down on Gilmer Avenue at the time.
Oh, okay. What was the name of the grocery store? Do you remember? The
Neighbor's one? Grocery Store across the street.
And the boys and girls, they had separate YMCAs?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay, and you would do, you would have dances at each or just over at the boys?
At each. On Wednesday, we had dances at the boys' Y on Wednesday night, and again on Saturday night. And the girls' Y, which was down on Gilmer, that was on Friday night. And then, of course, naturally, we go to the Y during the week to shoot pool and things of that nature, ping pong. And then just the regular chat. It was like a fraternity or a sorority house. You had to go there to meet. That was the structure, you know. You weren't at home with activities. You'd be at the library here all the while.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about your school life. Where did you attend school here?
I went to Harrison School. And then I went to Addison. The Addison at that time, I went 2 years at the old Addison because they closed it and built a new Addison. So I went 2 years at the old Addison School, and the new Addison School, I was the second class to graduate in 1954. The school was built in 1952, the new Addison, and I graduated there in 1954.
And it was still segregated at that point?
Oh, yes.
It was just, okay. Yeah. And was there a middle school? Was the...
No.
No.
No, at that time I went straight from Harrison School to Addison.
What, do you remember what grades were in Harrison?
One to eight.
One to eight, and then from
then
eight
I went
to
nine to 12, to high school at the time.
Okay. Did you have to walk to school?
Yes, I didn't live that far.
Okay.
In fact, most of the time I'd come back home and eat my lunch. Because I lived on Chestnut Avenue. Addison was just across the hill.
Were you ever allowed to stay home from school?
No. I might have missed in the whole time, maybe at the most, maybe 5 days, maybe.
And was that because you were really sick?
It was structured.
Did you have other things?
No, you couldn't, if you didn't go to school or Sunday school, that was out. at that time. You just didn't have no choice. You had to go.
So did you completed through the 12th grade. Did you ever have, did you ever go to college or vocational school?
Yes.
Can you tell me about that?
I went to, college. You know, first, I went for temporary time, I went to Virginia State. But then next, I went to Bluefield and, graduated from Bluefield, and then I finished Western Kentucky University. But, after I graduated from college, I started teaching and coaching in Clifton Forge, Virginia.
Okay. Did you get your master's degree, a bachelor's degree?
Yes, I got my master's degree from Western Kentucky University.
And what was that in?
Counseling, guidance, and administration with a principalship endorsement.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. I'm going to ask you a few questions now about your life at home and growing up. Can you describe your home life? For instance, did you gather around the radio in the evening with your family? Or do you remember the first time you got a telephone or refrigerator? Or a lot of people have talked about, they remembered when they got party lines or chat lines like that.
Life at home, we were, I didn't realize until I grew up how rich we were to have a mom and daddy that was really structured. That's the first thing. They were very religious people, which meant that if we didn't go to church on Sunday, you were grounded if you didn't go to school. Now, at home, we talked about positive things, and the main thing we talked about was the importance of getting an education, being an African-American. There was no excuse for you not going to school and trying to do well. So we took one of the things I like about then that they don't have now, you see, we had structured time to eat at a dinner table. Now, it wasn't fancy, but that's where the play started, like a football player. Mom and daddy told us to play for the day, didn't want no stuff, didn't want the school to call you. If you did, that's it. You know, it wasn't no answer about the teacher did this or that. They just put the phone down and you had it. So you knew you had to have the structure, which was the play for the day. You ate breakfast together, and you knew what you had to do during the day. So at home, it was beautiful for it, because even some of the things that we couldn't afford to get, daddy or mother could pick up, like old books and magazines, and bring them home, we could read. So that's why I'm saying they were rich, because they knew how to go out and get things for the children to us to better ourselves.
So you never, would it be fair to say you never felt like you knew you were doing without anything, because you always felt like you had plenty?
No, we were rich because, like I said, you got mom and daddy you can trust.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
You felt like you had what you needed.
That's it. I didn't need anything. Anytime you could come home and find your mother there, and daddy worked 5 jobs, and then 2 of them, we worked together as a family. As I told you, we had to help clean up the employment office, as well as the Christian Science Church on Saturday. So by having mom and daddy, the other things you didn't need, and daddy always made sure. In fact, now, we always had more for Christmas than I think it was needed, because daddy, he worked those 5 jobs. And then sometimes I have to laugh about it now, because I'm not as outgoing about Christmas as my wife and daughter, because daddy always had electric train, I think because he wanted to play with it too, to be frank about it. So I never felt neglected, because there were some things they taught, like daddy taught me on the buffer machine when they got the electric one, that, you know, he said, son, I want you to use the buffer with one hand. And I was 5 years of age. I said, daddy, I see you use it with 2 hands. He said, I want you to know that if you can use this buffer with one hand, this is a tough world, and it's sad how it is, but you got to remember, if you're not strong as maybe as the other race, you might not make it. So if you can do this buffer with one hand, when you get 2 hands on it, you can beat anybody. And that's how I grew up. I just thought I just could do it. He taught me self-esteem there and then, you know, that if you can put a little extra more, you can beat anybody, you know, and that's how it taught me in life, to be successful. I always feel now I got another hand.
Do you remember listening to the radio or?
Yes, Can't help but think about Joe Louis. I used to watch it at Joe Louis when Smelling Them Fort. We got one in the neighborhood. It was a man up street guy one first. When I was in high school, we were together and look at his TV. And we got one around about 54, 55. We got our first one. But the neighborhood was close. And I grew up the street with their family, and we watched TV when they got theirs. They got their TV before we did.
Would lots of families go to his house to watch the TV?
Oh, yeah. The first person would get something, you could go. Now, my mother was basically the cook, so a lot of people, when she'd make pies, a lot of people would come there, and Mama would serve that, Like I say, you could always bring your friends home. And we played games together. It was another good thing. We had family games. So it was that closeness that they got. And the thing that was so beautiful I liked about the neighborhood, anybody could correct the children. You better not go home and say that Miss So-and-so gave you a spanking. In fact, the lady up the street, her sons, we were playing cards one night, and I never forget it, that she jumped them and I started laughing and she gave me a beating, but I never did go home and tell Mama because first thing she said, you had no business up there. And anybody could correct me. I got several little spankings away from home and better not go home and tell them.
Would other people in the community, would they tell your parents if they saw that you were acting up or your sisters were acting up? So you couldn't get away with it.
You couldn't get away. In fact, if you got a scolding at school, beating at home, first thing you better try to get the people not to tell your mama. Of course, they were so structured, they're going to tell on you anyway. So they had a store across the street called Richard Acid, and they would sell bologna sandwiches for 5 cents. And you buy somebody bologna sandwich, and they still go home and tell on you. Because many times, soon as you come near at a corner, you could hear them. You gonna get a beat, and you gonna get a beat, which means they done broadcast the whole thing, and you try to be macho, and if they would give you that spanking, the windows were up, and how you afraid to cry, because the people gonna be outside laughing at you, and so I guess that was fun in a way, too, and one of the things that we had in the community, and I go over now, and we used to meet on the corner, it was a big rock, and we had to talk to each other, we talk to each other to get each other motivated. Said, look, we meet you at the rock. We got to talk this thing over. If your girlfriend quits you or if you had a problem, we meet at the rock. And on Chestnut Avenue, the corner, 5th Street and Chestnut Avenue, we call it the rock. We had to go talk.
That's fun. That's interesting. One thing I forgot to ask you earlier that I'd like to ask you, your sisters, were you older than them or?
In between them. Yeah.
Okay. Uh-huh. Good. Okay. And did you get along with them pretty well?
Yes. Uh-huh. Like I say, the reason why we had teamwork was stressed a lot back here. One of the things about economics, sometimes you can get food. But when you need each other as a team, see, we were taught teamwork. We had to stick together. And that was together because, as I told you, the play was in the morning, that what you had to do. And you just had to take care of your sisters, So that was stretch,
Did your sisters attend college?
Well, one of them did.
Did she?
One of them got nursing training. The oldest one did. And the young one, she went to Bluefield State and finished, and she has a master's also from UVA. And she was a teacher in the Long City Schools for years. She retired too now.
Oh, okay. And what were your sisters' names again?
One was Virginia Mignon, Chubb Hale. They still lead the Chubb. And one was Lorice, the oldest, Penella Lorice, Chubb Wilson.
Chubb Wilson. Okay. What kind of chores did you have around the house or the neighborhood that you had to do? You said you worked with your family for the two jobs.
Yeah.
Were there other things?
A lot
that
of times I had
for?
To be responsible a lot of times getting wood and coal. And, you know, we had a coal stove. And I was an expert on firing that a lot because I always did get up early in the morning, you know. So that was it. And then I had jobs. In fact, when I was, say, 8 or 10, I learned how to earn money, you know, with my wagon up on 11th Street. They had a grocery store. And I would take my wagon on Saturdays and go up to the grocery stores. And when the people would get off, get their groceries, they would come out and I would haul the groceries home for them and never would charge them nothing. So what would happen, a lot of people worked at the North and Southern and they got paid on the 15th and the 30th and they would love to show off and say, Lord, that's a good fella there. And they gave me big tips because I never did charge nothing. I often tell people now, sometimes you set a price and somebody might want to pay you more. I learned from that, but I never did charge. And only 15 and 30 they get paid. And gosh, they give me good tips. So I guess when I was 12 years of age, I had, at that time, that was good money, about $200 in the bank. So really, I've never been broke.
Wow.
I've heard people say about being broke, but I never have. I've always been able to earn a honest dollar.
Okay. What sport? You said you played basketball. What kind of other activities did you do?
You know, a little shot pool, a little ping pong, and played a little football. But my main thing was basketball.
And you played at Aston. Did you ever play after high school?
Yeah, I played at Bluefield, and I played Virginia State for a while, but I played at Bluefield. And after that, that was about it. Then I went into coaching once I finished.
Okay, where did you coach at?
Clifton Forge High School. In fact, they're having a reunion this weekend, and I'm planning to go back at least maybe tomorrow. You know, they're having it this weekend, and that was my first, you know, coaching and teaching job, you know, where we did so many great things then. And that was also a segregated situation.
Were there stories in your family that were passed down from one generation to another? For instance, did your family have stories about the Civil War or about slavery, or did you have a favorite family recipe that your mother passed down?
Yeah, there were a lot of stories, you know, in fact, about Chilltown, Georgia, you know, how we were freeborn, you know. I never did get all the specifics, but we got maps to show how they came roughly out of North Carolina into Georgia, you know, and apparently we got a book written, and it's another person writing a book now. We were telling about what we owned at the time. I didn't believe it until 79. I went back to see. It was actually a Chilltown, Georgia. They had a whole town. So that story was told, but by not being able to travel, we didn't go back. We went back. My dad hadn't been back in 56 years, but someone passed. So I made him go back as well as my aunt. And the history is there. I wished I had gone back when I was in war coming up. But like it was said, see, daddy, he never did want to go back to Georgia. That's how rough it was. So we never did travel back. But when something happened that they got a little money from some property, I made sure we could go back. And I was just hurt not to have gone back before because the history is there.
Did you, a spouse or sibling, did or children ever serve in the military?
No.
You never did?
No, my dad and me.
Okay. What businesses or shops did your family frequent here in Roanoke? Do you remember certain stores that you would go to?
Yeah, we would go to, at times, we would go to Glen Minutes. Also, we go to Pew's, Hiram's. Those were the base presses. And those were some interesting experiences because then a whole lot of things you couldn't try on. You had to know your size. And they had white and colored fountains, so you just didn't go to the sign say white fountain, you know. So those instructions were given sometime before you left home. So you wouldn't be embarrassed.
So you weren't allowed to try on the clothes?
No. A lot of things you had to know your size at the time.
Do you remember the first time you got a suit? A couple of people have talked about that they remembered when they got their first suit and it meant a lot to them. Do you remember that?
No. The only thing I can say about that is I said my parents provided for me well. The only thing I hated about it is that you couldn't make a whole lot of things you couldn't try on. You had to sort of know your size. Mm-hmm. So just like my daddy, for Christmas, he bought me one of the better bicycles, a swim bicycle, because I said he worked 5 jobs. And Christmas meant everything to him because he didn't get it when he was coming up. So those things that I said by having mom and dad and working as a team, they knew how to cut the budget enough where we could get some of the better things. But the thing that always bothered me is how you had to go together. You know, you had to almost know your size or hat. Somebody, you go in, is you see other children playing with toys and all, and you can't touch, you know. Mm-hmm. Other races, that's what I'm spelling out to you. And that was very demeaning because somebody would snatch you. And you wonder, you know, well, I can't play like the other children.
So your mom and dad would tell you what you could or couldn't do before you left so that you wouldn't be embarrassed.
But then, so you wouldn't be embarrassed. But yet still, it was puzzling. You know, you just couldn't understand. So what happened to the learning process would hurt me a lot. Those things that you've been learning about your work, you learning how to behave for rights that you should own anyway. You know, how to act when you go this place, how to do this once you cross the bridge going that down, you know. You had to kind of know what to do. Because if you touched that and you didn't do that, somebody call your name. I've been calling many names. You know, you just wonder, you know, why, you know, somebody called you the name for nothing because you touched something or you looked at it, you know. So you learn, you know, in other words, you just didn't look at certain races, you know, you turn your head. You just taught that.
That's been very difficult.
It was difficult, you know. Like we talking here now, you know, then people wonder why some children, they bow their head and all. But, you know, you just can't look at nobody straight in the eye. You know, somebody told you what might happen to you. So all those things, that was part of the learning process.
And you
now,
learned,
what good is that?
Yeah, and you learned. You say you learned that from a very young age.
Young age, oh yeah, oh yeah. Where to go, be careful. Every now and then, you know, you see somebody, you know, say something. You go downtown, you know. And it's real interesting because, see, one of my duties, I was always, like I say, willing to earn money. And we had to shop for our groceries on the market, you know. So we lived in Northwest, and my mother would ride the bus, and I'd tell her to give me the money, and I'd beat her downtown. I'd run all the way downtown. But when I get downtown, I would get there early, enough sometimes to, you know, be tired and sit down, and somebody say, hey, get up off EM, so on, so you're wrong, you know, and you just be a little child sitting down, tired from running down to meet your mother to shop for groceries, you know. And then a lot of times, the tough experience was around Thanksgiving when VMI and DPI would play. And then I'd go there and try to sneak and look in the crowd. Somebody, hey, Ian, you'll never go there, you know. And all the time I said, well, I'm going to try to go to college one day, you know. And just saying, you know, somebody tell you, you know, that you just looking at the parade, you know, all the, it was crowded, the stadium, you know, they'd be marching. And you a little child trying to look through the crowd, you know. And somebody tell you that, you know, just things, you know, that just touch you when you talk about it, you know.
Mm-hmm. You said church was very important. What
very
church
important.
Did you attend?
St. Paul Methodist Church on 5th Street in Gilmore. I still attend there. In fact, the interesting thing about it, my wife attended church. We started church together, school together, and that's interesting, you know, and still together.
And so you met her when you were young?
Yeah, but we didn't talk then. You know, I found out that after going to school, everybody be your girlfriend, can't be your wife, so I came back home and settled down with the person I knew that grew up with a lot of structure like me. And I guess it paid off because we still together.
Good.
Sometimes it's tough, but we got enough family ties to know each other, and I think it helps a whole lot.
What is your fondest childhood memory? Did you have a favorite thing you would do at the holidays or a favorite place that you would go?
I would say one of the favorite things I've had, Daddy would walk us a lot to see the trains. You know, he loved trains. Like I said, we got electric trains. I got electric trains every Christmas. So I enjoyed that. The other thing I enjoyed playing by myself. In other words, I could take a basketball and go to Washington Park and shoot and play by myself. Now, that taught me that really that you don't have to be reaching out for nobody. You can do things by yourself. So that was the favorite thing. I did a lot of running back there, and I played basketball a lot of times by myself. And then we, like I say, Dad would take us walking to see the train sometime on Sundays.
What kind of work have you done throughout your life?
From the beginning?
Well, or how about after you graduated from college and, okay. and got your master's degree?
All right. Well, first I started working in Clifton Forest, Virginia. I was coaching, science teacher. And at that time, I coached three sports by myself. I hear I'm talking about assistant coaches now. I coached the girls' basketball team, the boys' football team, and the boys' basketball team by myself. Then after that, from 60 to 62, I worked in Clifton Forest. From 62 to 65, I worked at Booker T. Washington School, which was segregated at the time. So they needed some people to go to junior high, Monroe Junior High School. They needed some strong African-American teachers, so I was chosen with another person that stayed a half a year, but I was there the whole year by myself. That was an interesting experience because I went there to teach English and health and physical education. But they said I did so well until they moved me up, you know, in guidance. And from then, you know, I sort of moved up until I went to Western Kentucky. And that was real interesting. The system felt then that they could point me a principal of Harrison School, knowing they were going to close it because of desegregation of schools in 71. And they thought I would take a little flunky job like assistant principal. I told them, no, you appointed me a principal, I'm going to be a principal. So knowing that, you can imagine what that did, though, being African-American. Once you didn't go along with the system, I was blackballed. So that made me work hard and use that philosophy my daddy taught me. You always got another hand. So I excelled well then, you know, in fact, they had like special days for Richard L. Children and all because I could just work 65 hours a week. In fact, I had a community aid program. We started like it. I go to work at 6:30 and leave at 10 o'clock at night because we had parent groups. We had like the police dialogue groups at every part of school. And I stayed there 16 years, you know, until, well, 15 years. And then I just took a leave of absence, you know. I knew I wasn't going to move up because they held that against me by taking a stand. Once they closed Harrison School, then they wanted me to be assistant principal. I said, no, I'm going to be a principal. So they asked the person at Hurt Park that was black, and they put me up there, you know. So that's how that happened. So it's been very interesting. The other job I had, I also had a counseling consulting business down the street here. In Southwest Community Development Fund, and I closed that 2 years ago. So now I'm probably doing some consulting work again. I think the people begin to believe what I was telling them all the time was right about the school business. Mm-hmm. So it's been exciting to me because I was a workaholic, you know, and I enjoyed the children, but I couldn't play with the bureaucracy of the world.
So you said Hyde Park?
Hurt Park in Southwest.
Were you the principal there then?
Yes, I was there for 15 years, and then I just took a leave absence. opened up the business down here in Gainesville in counseling and consulting work. And then when I went back, you know, I stayed there long. I thought I might be going somewhere else, but the parents demanded I come back, you know, and I'm glad I did now, because people put out things, maybe they ran him away and whatever it might be. So I went back for 1 year, then I set up a counseling program for at-risk students for central office, and then I just went on and retired. I was 55 then.
Okay. And you said you started doing little odd jobs. You always worked with your father. You did little odd jobs since you were 8.
Right.
And then you basically worked you worked your entire life.
Yeah. In fact, after the wagon experience, I told you, hauling groceries, people in the community, mm-hmm. I was a newsboy for 3 years, newspaper boy.
For the Tribune or for the
Times? No, for the Wrong Time.
Okay.
Yeah, that was an interesting experience. See, at the time, you had to collect your money, so a lot of times people didn't pay. But it taught me another side of life, too, you know, and that was that sometimes parents teach the children to lie. I knock on the door, and the child will come to the door and say, Mama says she's not here. And then I go, I say, wait a minute, Mama must have been there to be able to tell them, you know. So from that newsboy, I worked at Children's Bakery. I had to be at work at 6 o'clock in the morning. And then rush home and change and go to school, then come back at 4. And then I worked at the Norfolk and Southern Railroad, but that was in the dining hall at the time. They had a dining hall when the railroad was a booming business. And I worked there, you know, for a while. And then my senior year, you know, some way I could work it in where I could play ball.
Okay. Let's see, you said that you came to the library a lot. Do you have any special memories of Gainesboro Library or Miss Virginia Wiley?
That's Miss Lee. She was a strong pillar in this area. You just love, she was so attractive, you know. You just love this coming here and for tell you, you know, Richard, get out the library. You're not here just to meet a young lady. Just go on out and meet here, you know. And so those are the things she would talk to you and just go in there just to hear her say that. Get out there, Richard. You're not coming here to read no books. You just come here to meet a little girl, you know. And which might have been the truth, you know, to be frank about it.
Did she, did you do reading contests, or do you remember some of the books that you read?
I can't remember all of the books other than the person and the interperson. That's what I say to people. Fail to realize, even in school, you might not remember 2 + 2, but what that person did for you, the personal things. And like I say, that meant a whole lot for her to come in here just for her to tell me that, all right, Richard, you're not coming here to read the books, you know. So, but there were some, you know, basic books that we read, you know, that I thought was great, because she always had things like connected with African American history, you know, like Booker T. Washington and things. This is why I'm glad this research is good, because we're not talking about Booker T. We're talking about people here in Roanoke who have done some outstanding things, and children need to know that here. They need to know that did Richard Chubb come through this situation, and what did he experience, and still function as well as someone else, you know. But a lot of times we study about, you know, Booker T. or someone else, but there are people here in Roanoke who have done great things too. A lot of times it didn't get published, you know, but it did great things. If not, we wouldn't be here now.
Can you tell me a little bit about cultural events that happened in Gainesboro? For example, do you remember entertainers who came to the Dumas? Or special performances? Did you go to the Dumas entertainers?
Oh, yeah, but not only at the auditorium. It was great. They had people like Roy Hamilton, the Five Keys, the Satins, I think, and Roy Hamilton. And it was just so beautiful because they would stay at the Dumas, like Little Richard. I've seen Little Richard, Count Basie. You know, I've seen the big people there on Henry Street at Dumas. But they also, the Star City Auditorium, it was Roanoke Auditorium, and then they had Star City up in the black community they built. But that was a great experience to see the top entertainers. come to India. In fact, they used to have some of them come to Club Morocco.
Do you have a favorite that you, an all-time favorite who you heard play here?
Roy Hamilton.
Who's your favorite?
Unchained Melody. Oh, my love, my darling, I hunger for your touch.
Would you go there on dates? Would you take dates there to the to hear entertainers? Or
no, at the time, you know, it was an expensive thing at the time. So most of the time, the guys, we get together and go. And things of that nature.
Okay. Miss Lee, you say she was important as a role model. Were there other community, strong community leaders or role models that you had here in the community?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Some of them, Dr. Pena. There were, the thing I always enjoyed about it, they had the Harold Martin Board of Officials. Those were, people who coached, I mean, who officiate basketball and football games. So that was a good role model because I always wanted to be an official. So I ended up officiating games too with the Harold Martin Board of Officials. It was all African American group of officials, you know. So then there were other role models like Reuben Lawson, a lawyer, Fred Lawson, who was a coach at the school, Tom Payne, you know, which even when he got on his sick bed, I was able to spend a lot of time with him. So many role models, and it really helped a lot, you know, because see what happened then. By being segregated, you went to church a lot of time with your teachers. So you would see them a lot. You know, a lot of times now, some of the children now, they don't see no role models because everybody moved away and the schools are not in the area. That's one thing that was great about segregation. You know, you had to feed off each other. You had to feed off the business here. And you would see people. You'd see, like we're talking about the top stars, entertainment. Because you could walk to the movies and you walk by Dumas. You go to church, some of your teachers are at church too, so you couldn't. Because they might tell your mama some of the same teachers, the coaches in the school, they were at the same church I attended.
Were there shops or stores on Harrison that had that you went to a lot?
Oh, yes.
Can you tell me about some of those?
Well, the principal had a grocery store next to Harrison School one time. Then across the street was a Richard Acid store. Then Earl Jones, he had a barber shop midway of Harrison. And there were stores just throughout, you know, the community. Then Gainsborough was here. There was Neighbor's Grill. That was the ideal meeting place for us after the movies.
And where was the movie theater located?
Over, on Wales, I would cross from, I'm quite sure that's not Wales, but it's, diagonally was crossed from Dumas.
Okay.
Which was, the theater was there.
And it was a segregated theater?
Yes.
Okay.
And then sometimes they open up the, theater downtown and we had to go up, you know, go upstairs, you know, and there was tough, but you know, a lot of times mama and them didn't allow, but I would slip. And then finally they would let me go because they just said it's second class. But that's where we had to go when they opened up the movies downtown. We had to sit upstairs. Came all those steps the way upstairs. So at the time we had the theater over across from Dumas.
Let's see. How has Gainsborough changed over the years?
The neighborhood got shot, if you think about it. One of the things about it, when they put, if you look, they put almost a bypass through the community from Orange Avenue, where the Y, it doesn't look like a neighborhood no more. And see, that's what happened. It reminds me of someone to me who have really bombed the area. Like Iraq, to be frank about it. In fact, when they came in 1995, they came with the Commonwealth Project. Well, I finished high school in 1954, and when I came back home, I didn't understand what they were doing with the bulldozers in the Northeast and they did call it the Commonwealth Project. Then it turned right around in 1964 with the Kimmel Project, and then 1968. So to me, to see the hills and things gone, it's not like it used to be. You know, they came through with the bulldozer. And the sad part about it is sometimes I drive through and try to picture certain places, and I can't, and just tear up your whole history. So no one knows that effect, and that's why it was good that Dr. Manny Fuller Love, I don't know if you read the book Root Shock, and she interviewed several of us in that book, and I was just telling them, one of the things why I had like my office, I could get up at the Wonder and look out and saw all the beauty of Henry Street, and some days I wouldn't have a client, and tears would just roll down my cheeks just thinking about, you know, what used to be, because I always wanted, I didn't know I was going to college, but I always wanted to have a business on Henry Street growing up, you know, that was the main thing. And then I would talk to Mr. Barlow, who was the owner of Dumas, and I'm glad I listened to what he was saying. There was another role model. He said, yeah, it'd be nice to have a business there, but it'd be so nice if you get your education too. And showing up is true, because suppose I didn't depend on a business, I might not be working there.
So what they call urban renewal, it obviously changed the physical landscape of things, but it also had a strong emotional impact.
It's a shock. I don't see what I'm saying. It hit me that the Supreme Court passed the law May 1754, you know, about desegregation school and all. And then you come home from school and all these bulldozers and your friends being moved. And through urban renewal, there were some people who lost their, well, they lost everything because they told them they could have a certain amount of money and they could move in the upper Northwest, which was really the white population. And they didn't give them full amount for the house, so they didn't have enough money to pay for them, so they lost. Because they figured what some of them were shacks. That's where they felt about it. But it was homes. Home is different from a house. And it really confused me. In fact, I think it had a burn on me so much until I was summoned to be at court with the Claytor Prophet. I don't know if you read that article.
But Dr. Sharif was talking about
that. Yeah, I wrote him up, you know, and they didn't like that, but he won that property. But I think by not only him, but the other people who were black in Northeast, they didn't get nothing for their homes enough to go pay on another one, and he lost them. In other words, you had a house paid for, and they give you $5,000, $8,000 on a $20,000 house, and you don't have enough to lose. So that really bothered me, and I don't know why I ended up being chosen to be down there to hear that, because it still affected me from that now, you know, because I thought about it. I thought about all of the friends I had who down there, they were talking about it and said, you know, we're going to have to move. I said, why are you going to move? You just live here. Well, you know, daddy going to lose a house, or they got to go in the projects, and then put the projects in. And that took away, you know, the old community that I own the house. You know, and so, that's really lasting now to be thinking about it.
So it had a large impact on your life. How did desegregation in the civil rights movement, how did that affect you? Were you encouraged by it, or were you just didn't realize how it would affect you in such a broad way?
Well, I knew it from in a way that it had to be a tough thing, because I knew it was going to break up the community, you know. So how it affected me, as I was telling you, now that you see everything in the world that happened, even in schools and all, because once you're out the neighborhood, and I told you that closeness, then you lose something, because sometimes people get confused. Now, don't get me wrong, if you bring a lot of African Americans in here and view them, some of them biologically didn't affect them like it might affect me. It just hit everybody different, how you feel about it, because we went through it different times. For instance, it's three in my family. We can sit down and talk about it. And we get in a big debate sometimes because they don't see what I saw at the time that affected me. So you find a lot of people, they want to be authority on what to speak for black people. You can't do that. It affected us all differently.
So there were different lines of people who thought it was a good thing
yeah.
and thought it was a bad thing.
Oh,
and
they, yeah.
It affected the
That's
way the community
don't have industry.
Felt about each
That's
other.
That's why we don't have industry. Some people thought it was good, you know, and they couldn't see the Trojan horse. You know, they couldn't
yeah.
see that once you get in there and you're dealing with money, you're going to be wiped out. And you're going to be controlled, you know. And so that's why I say that biologically, you would say, well, okay, that person from Runoff, I know they're going to speak because it was bad, but that's not necessarily so. You might even speak sometimes better than somebody in the community because some of them, it was a hurtful thing. I know some folks that grew up with me, they can't talk about it on a negative context, because sometimes it was just cruel to them. They see it as, they don't want to even talk about it no more, you know, because it's just a tearful type thing for them, and they don't want to even identify with it. To me, I believe the only way you're going to be successful is don't tell me where you're going until you show me where you have been. And that's really why a lot of times that I've gotten in trouble job-wise, because I tell the truth, I speak the truth. Nobody wants to hear the truth. They want to try to bubble it up like it didn't happen and all that. So the truth of it just had a terrible impact on it. And as I told you before, from 1954 on, you know, it's just been something that's over and over that you can just see that what damage it did do. You know, in other words, if they had sat down when they desegregated schools and see, they put children in predicaments that they, the adults should, the teachers should have experienced this first. Black teachers, well, it's white. If they put children in even Little Rock, I just think about that situation, you know, and I've been down to Little Rock and I look at the History Museum and you can see what children had to go through, you know, calling names and all. And we use children to experience some things that never would work, you know.
I wish we had more time. We're almost out of time.
Okay.
I want to thank you for participating, but before I close, is there anything else that we didn't talk about that you would like to share?
Well, the other thing about it, and of course, I can leave you some literature I left a column on some of the things that happened to me in the school system, you know, about how I was outspoken, and how it didn't help a lot of times telling the truth, but the truth shall make you free. I'm thankful now because it's a whole new group in that understand what I was trying to tell them years ago about it. Schools and dealing with people, the personal and the interpersonal. And that's important, you know, when you take everybody out and try to retire them that grew up in the community, not saying that people can't come in, but when you don't have that many resources that got the history of what you're doing. Well, Chubb taught my mama, and he taught so-and-so and this kind of network. And that's what's happening to a lot of times because the children don't know nobody. They don't know their teachers. They don't know where they're from. And I'm glad you folks are doing this history.
Good. Thank you for participating.
Thank you.
It was
a
really
pleasure.
Nice to meet you.
Okay. Have a great day.
Thanks.